You're listening to Belly Up to the Blackboard, the podcast made for teachers by teachers. From classroom chaos to those unforgettable student moments, we'll cover the ins and outs of education and share the advice you need to avoid the biggest pitfalls. So belly up, grab your favorite drink, and let's get started.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Today, we have a great interview. We have Matt Sandoval, CEO of Free Arts. Matt, how's it going today?
I'm wonderful, Chris. Great to be here.
So to start off, can you tell us how your journey from, the beginning into education to where you're at now?
Yeah, sure. I've at the point in my career where there's lots of stops and starts there, and someone teased me once in public for saying, this means Matt's had a lot of jobs, but it's just about growth and new opportunities. And I'm definitely one of those people that values trying new things. That doesn't mean I quit after a year, but I've definitely had a few different roles and responsibilities that have all kind of culminated in where I am now. So let me just start with where we're at now, and I'll kind of go back to the beginning, if you will.
Sounds good.
So Free Arts is an organization in Phoenix that's been inspired by one other agency in LA, also called Free Arts. And so the name is kind of vague. What does that mean? What do you do? And we actually do group-based mentoring for children in some form of out-of-home care. So they're in foster care, they live in shelters because they're experiencing homelessness, domestic violence, or these are children or teens who live in treatment centers. So even within the general educational context, we know these kids are in our general population. We also know that they might be at different times children that need extra care and comfort. They might be the type of children that are coming to school in a van from a group home, and there's six of them across an age and spectrum, and they've just spent the last weekend with each other 72 hours and they can't wait to meet some other human being. So as a teacher and as a counselor and people that all the roles that I've had in school environments, that was kind of how I associated, oh, this is, a small pocket of who's in a general public school, while also knowing that there are a lot of other children who experience at some point significant adversities or traumas. And so I've been at Free Arts for 3 years. I'm excited to tell you and your audience that we're actually in the process of changing our name, and it's important to where we're going with it. So we're going to become Art Heals Arizona, and taking a little of the vagueness of the free art term out of it, but also embedding us in essentially what we hope to do, which is use this definition of art and healing, which is for us a return to well-being. And we believe that at every stage of our life and at every component, every environment we find ourselves in, there is an opportunity to find the highest level of well-being and functioning. And so depending on our situation, whether we're a student, we're a staff member, we're a teacher, groups themselves are always going through these experiences of growing and finding some baseline from which to consider new risks to grow and to challenge. And this is all part of a school environment. So that's where we're going. That's where we're headed. And that's my current placement now, reversing the clock a bit, about 25 years now. I was a math teacher for a couple of years. My first week teaching immediately preceded 9/11. So that was a very interesting time to be in a public space and supporting children as, the nation was going through a very difficult thing. So again, adversity and traumas are always part of the classroom, whether we plan for them or not. So I've taught, that led me to some alternative-based programs in nonprofits, helping children who were credit deficient graduate on time. That led to a long career for me in a national nonprofit of 14 years, building up skills and different leadership capacities all the way up to the VP level, supervising workforce development, alternative education, and mentoring services. Then somewhere in middle age, I decided to go back to school and say, yes, I like leading and administrating, and I also like strategic thinking and building new programs, but I want to also develop a toolkit to do this with the mental health skills that are available. And so I got a Master of Social Work about 5 years ago. And so that means outside of my work at Free Arts, in a very small way, I still am in practice as a therapist, mostly working with adults, some teenagers, and then a lot of relationship counseling. And so all of that weaves together that I've been in a lot of public spaces serving the greater good, but with some commonalities of recognizing that the human experience has a lot of shareable components, no matter who you are. We all come into this world with a mix of resources, some that are enough, some that are more than we need, and some that we might be lacking. And that causes us to adapt. And so in the modern classroom, you add in 25 to 30 young people, you're seeing the full spectrum of what resources might have been available, as well as temperaments and skills toward adaptation. And that creates opportunity on a good day, but some real challenges on other days. And so I'm very pleased to be here to summarize my intro to kind of connect worlds in that what we do as an adjacent nonprofit to people who care for children during the school hours, help them learn and grow. These are things in which when they are woven together in a helpful way, really help the outcomes of everyone involved. So that's who I am in a nutshell, a little bit longer than that, than a brief introduction, but yeah, it's taken some time and effort to get here. And so here we are.
No, it's, I'm glad you shared that. So one of the things when we started the podcast was to, we always usually at the end give tips to young teachers, you know, of things we've went through and maybe pitfalls to avoid. And so I do have a question for you. So you said you started right before 9/11. That was your first teaching job. Okay, so mm-hmm. we all know teaching as a new teacher is hard as it is, right? Now to deal with something, how were you able to, like, can you go through that experience with us of how, like, starting, you're brand new, and then all of a sudden a national tragedy, and you've got to figure out how to, you know, work through that with kids. And what grade level was it too?
I was teaching high school math.
Okay.
Which meant there was some ability and challenge around that. So I think there is, this is, I think, also a tip for your audience. There's the way I would have answered it then, and there's the way I would answer it now. And both of those answers are true in a way, even though they might be different. So at the time of, and it's just hard for a lot of people to gather unless they were there to see it. I think our nation and the world was really shocked by what had occurred. Of course, in total humility, things like this happen in other places of the world. But when it comes to your backyard, it really is a reckoning. It really causes people to change. And I was describing this. I now have colleagues with birth dates, you know, in and around that time period. So they don't remember. They don't know what that's about. And given your audience, it's probably the case for some or too little to know what was occurring. But those who have lost the same amount of hair that I have can remember this time period where things have actually, things were very different for a while. And so that created both this episode of hurt and shock, created opportunity for people to connect, which is a very weird dynamic that occurs in all challenges. You don't want to say that's a silver lining, and I don't even want to say that's the purpose of a bad thing like that happening, but it is an opportunity that creates. And so I do remember the immediate days after things being different, but also teenagers are going to be teenagers, which meant some who are more attuned to world events were very impacted, some that are armored up because of their the way of living, the way that they've experienced other stressors would kind of come and go as if this wasn't bothering them at all. And so what was a challenge then was realizing how far you could move a group who is going through this other situation that is taking a lot of time and energy. So it was very dysregulating to the world. I think very young people realized if this is a militarized solution for any length of time, which ended up being the case, mm-hmm. that they might likely be involved, right? And people were very motivated to do what they could to help this scenario. But that really brought home for very young people that, wow, this is protracted conflict. That's going to impact me. I was in Arizona when it occurred, so it wasn't likely that people in our space actually knew someone that was impacted directly. But those closer to the East Coast, you're almost 100% where either you or someone you know was directly impacted. So that, of course, introduces personal and collective grief. I think what was helpful is that there were moments of silence, collective understanding over a series of weeks. I mean, you saw wild things like the World Series get delayed a week. I mean, there was a pause on the mundane, which we might get excited about, but a pause on the mundane to give space for this heavy thing. And I believe as adults, when these things happen, we have an opportunity to model how to carry pain in a way that allows us to function, but doesn't ignore either one. So we don't necessarily need to become overwhelmed to the point where we cannot function, and we don't need to overfunction so that we believe that we can't feel. So there are times where in a classroom, we might have started with a thought or a quote or a moment of silence. Some subjects immediately lend themselves to this because they're processing courses, right? If you're writing English, you're doing expressive writing, this might be the topic for a while, an art class, a history class. And I do think that coming to math and for some students just being able to deal with numbers was an okay break from some of the things that they were dealing with and thinking about. So I think that's good. And that's kind of how I would answer it from that time period here. Now with a bit more time and other things impacting us and seeing the collective weights of grief. And we can look back in history and see where as a group, as a society, we've handled things well and where we've been challenged around that. I also think that collectively, and this is probably the school, those who lead, as a teacher, you are a leader, whether you recognize it or not. You're a very powerful leader. You have immediate day-to-day influence over young lives. And those young lives, whether they're grumpy or not, look up to you. They take cues from you. So allowing our systems to actually show that they're made up of humans is very important. And so when I think about that experience then versus how I would define it now, we create space for heartbreak, right? One of the things that we talk about at Free Arts, we exist so that we can take someone who's experiencing heartbreak, transform it through the arts so that heartbreak doesn't get the last word. And we're not pretending that we can completely bypass the hardships, the hurt, but we can take what we have, feel it deeply, mold it, use creativity for us to shape it in some place that makes sense to us, that has a start, a middle, and an end. Even if we continue to come back to it, things like journaling, continuing to collage, different things that we might make together. Also, I think communities put together in these times collective murals and statements and memorial and ways to express really the difficulties that are beyond words. And then again, I think, which is true now versus then, we have an opportunity to allow kids to witness how adults carry the weight of the world and the mundane, right? We might in a class have a moment, we might have some sharing, and then we might take 5 deep breaths and go do some factorials. We might go do some long division. We might write a poem. We might go to PE, and that we can do both. We don't have to turn one off. So yeah, that's a great question and actually made me think a lot about it, given all the things that people are going through as they're listening to this.
Yeah, I was old enough. I was a freshman in college when it happened. So it's a fall of my freshman year, and I had a late class while I was sleeping in, and my roommate came in and woke me up and told me that, you know, a plane had hit one of the towers, and I thought he was screwing with, you know, messing around and a bad joke. And then all of a sudden we're watching it, and all of a sudden we see the second one hit, and you couldn't wrap your mind around it, because it's one of those events. For us anyways, you know, in the United States, of, you know where you were at. You remember where you were at. And one of the eerie things was, you know, no planes in the skies for, I don't know if it was a couple of days, I can't remember now, but nothing. You didn't see the, you know, the the path or anything like that. And excuse me, it was just, yeah, it was one of those moments. You just, hard to wrap your mind around. And, you know, it wasn't in high school, so I was interested to see how, like, you know, how did teachers deal with it. With those students. And, you know, I think it's probably a little different than they would deal with it today, maybe. But, yeah, I don't even know the word to explain what it was. You know, it was just a tragedy, and you had to figure out what you were going to do and, you know, how to cope with it, I guess.
Yeah, there have been transitions among generations, because I do think, and I've heard this bit from more than one comedian, so I could just give it without trying to be funny, of a Gen X person, somebody who's in their mid to late 40s up to almost 60 at this point, who says, trauma-informed? What are you talking about? Like, I, you know, was told one day at school, we're going to watch a teacher go into space on the shuttle, and we all know what happened to that mission. And I had this actually happen where, like, that was the idea. This is going to happen. And then that was exciting. We weren't watching it live, but a parent did come to the school to tell the teacher what had occurred. And he even brought a videotape. And wisely, our teacher was like, we're not going to show that. We're going to let parents decide what the kids see about this. And it'll be on the news anyway. So I don't think that I want to create the theater for that here. So what I'm saying is, in that time period, 1986, I think it was, the general collective thought was, well, how kids will just see it anyway. And maybe we shouldn't think about how best to present the hardships that happen here. Then you think at like what 9/11 meant and how people started to adjust. And then even now, where I do think there's a lot of interest and motivation about how best to support people through a hardship and not exposing them to things that are traumatizing or potentially re-traumatizing. Mm-hmm. So I do think our field's growing, but that is the experience of my own life of why are these people, these Gen X people, so independent and kind of hard nuts to crack? Well, we walked home with generalized anxiety disorder without a label, no counselors on staff, certainly no mental health clinics, no student-led mental health support. And then we had things like those, the troubles of the general 80s that occur, and we kind of white-knuckled the whole thing on our own. And so now it's hard for us to ask for help. You know, we don't do that very well. And the generations after us are much better about this, much better, even if they get a little mixed up with a little too much TikTok therapy. But these are at least, you know, signs of progress that are good.
Oh, absolutely.
I think,
go ahead, Bree.
Go ahead, Chris. Like, I'm a millennial, so I was in fourth grade when 9/11 happened, so I have a different perspective. They didn't tell us anything. We just went home, and my aunt was at my grandma's house, and she's not normally there. And they just kind of talked to us a little bit. My grandma just kind of talked to me a little bit about what was going on, and I didn't really understand. But I think you're right with like the generations, like millennials. I think we are getting there with getting more help like we need for our trauma. But I think that has definitely been a cycle.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, and Bree's younger than I am. I guess would be a zillennial. You know, I was born in 1982. So, you know, now if there's a tragedy or something that happens locally, they bring in counselors, they bring in, you know, somebody to talk to students or staff. And I don't remember that and we didn't, you know, I can't think of a lot of tragedies that happened when I was in school, but I don't ever remember having extra staff or counselors to come in to talk to kids. It just seemed like you just went about your day and you dealt with it. And maybe at home you talked to your parents, and there wasn't a lot of classroom time really, talking about it as either.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember a lot of like traumatizing things happening like at my school, but I know that there's been several things that have happened in the last like 10 years in my education career, and they have brought counselors and grief people in, and people have spent, like, kids have spent all day in the counseling office, which I think has been huge for helping them.
Yeah. It makes a big difference, right? Around the same time period, the biggest names who write on these things, Bruce Perry, Bessel van der Kolk, all these people, I mean, you see their what grow into seminal works starting in the mid-90s and later. And this is the impact of collective research, which I think really got started by people who were working with returning Vietnam veterans. And so our general societal, I guess at our best moments clinically, and then in the supportive of school, they come from examining what occurs to veterans. And then in social environments and into interpersonal traumas, which absolutely are 100% alive in your school, even if it's not something you could turn the TV on, you're having students that are going through very difficult situations at home. And the essentials around that care are really clear, right? Access, and available contact to caregivers. And as a teacher, as an educator, you're there so often. I mean, it's the old joke of like accidentally, you know, being embarrassed because you called your teacher mom, but like you're around them so much that you said, mom, oh wait, that's not who you are. You're missing it. And the class laughs. But we all feel that, right? That we've been together so long that that takes a pseudo caregiver role. And so the availability to safe people creates that safety for us to process on a couple strands, right? Depending on our age, development has a big component to this. When these difficult things happen, we handle it differently. So sometimes people have different sets of memories, even in the same family, because they might have been slightly older, which gave them a little bit more cognitive space and maybe a different social network. And that is a trade-off between two major systems in our thinking, right? There's explicit memory, which is what it decodes dates, times, and events. You know, did you go to the store on the way home and get the milk? That's an explicit memory, right? That is recall, did you go and do my task for me? Then there's implicit, which is where adversity and trauma really live, because this is where we can become very sensitive to just the feeling of a certain thing. So you can evoke a memory. And for those who might have seen it where it's heavy, our mention today of 9/11 probably took people back to some central core feelings, probably straight in the chest of what is happening. I was on the West Coast, right? I'm in Arizona, so it's not quite the beach, but we're far enough where we weren't quite up yet. So 9:15 Eastern time was 6:15 for us. So we got phone calls from relatives that, you know, at that point in their life, can't sleep past six anyway. So they called to tell us. So it was immediately the bad news of two towers, right? Of being impacted. And I said to my wife, as soon as she told me what was the message on the phone, that's no accident. So I remember the feeling, both using language to describe this is not an accident, and then the body feeling. So this is what's happening to the little people in our spaces, is that they may have some ability around forming some coherent thought about what's occurring. Her body is taking in this information, this energy, and that implicit memory structure and storing, this is that home of why we behave the way we do later, why we're too easily agitated, why we appear to be hostile, why we melt down at the earliest difficulty, why we're sometimes good at school and bad at home, or good at home and bad at school. These are all that those functions, depending on our developmental stage, that are coming home. And we've learned that sense by examining some of these things. So if there's any lesson to take from it, is that I guess our species is getting wiser at understanding not only what hurts, but how does it hurt, so that we might be able to mitigate some of those effects. So our mere presence in the time of a tragedy and crisis is super powerful, not only just for our classes or students, but for each other, right? Again, that comes back to that opening that exists in a hardship, that this is an opportunity to connect in a different way, even if it's temporary.
Well, and we talk about, and we've mentioned it in with, you know, other teachers before too, just in, you know, in passing, you see kids that they come to school, but they don't go to class, but then they're there till like 5 PM, you know, 'cause they don't want to go home because this is the most stable environment. And I think that's where hopefully a lot of that healing, you know, you're a safe person to talk to, or, you know, you have an understanding. And the more I'm in, the longer I've been teaching, you know, this is year 19, I think, for me, is you have that understanding of kids come into the classroom and kids come into school with, you know, something happened at home, and just knowing, having the ability to work around, okay, they may not be able to do anything first hour. They just need to decompress and de-stress and you know, as a new teacher, we got to get this done. So it doesn't matter, full steam ahead. And now, especially in my special education classroom, it's okay, let's deal with this first. Let's work through this first, because otherwise it's just going to continue to fester, or, you know, they just need a little bit of time or somebody to talk to. Otherwise it's, you know, I think that's the biggest part of our job that we don't see a lot of the times, but maybe in a smaller class, I see it more. But, you know, work can come second. You know, let's work mm-hmm. through, you know, whatever it may have been that happened this morning on the way to school, or, you know, before you got picked up.
Yeah, I agree, because what you're essentially doing there is giving people permission to be human. And one of the hardest things to accept is us being against your will, and face it, you have to go to school, right?
Yeah.
So it's, for most people, it's enjoyable and they would be bored without it. But at some point we have to remember this is mandatory. And so they have to be there. And how do we make something make sense when it we have to be there? We create conditions where learning can happen. What's interesting in our work is that we're adjacent to the education field, right? And I'm thinking of this at a systems level around funding. So we're a nonprofit, we raise funds, everything we do is really done by donations, both corporate, foundation, and individual givers. Sometimes when I'm dealing with institutions that give, they might be in the lane of education and they're not sure that we relate. And to me, nothing else relates better than what are the things that cause a child to be ready to learn at school? Because it isn't the cool worksheet. It isn't the brand new textbook. It might not even be the fancy looking computer they have or the newest furniture. They're the cues that happen around safety and belonging and exactly what you're saying, Chris, that on a difficult Monday after a long weekend or after a long weekend emotionally, sometimes we actually do have long periods where stress goes up when the kids are not in school. We know that feeling after the holiday break that certain students are going to be pretty dysregulated because they've been around difficult circumstances, that we have to do a very important thing, which is recognize the humanity of the little people in front of us, give them space to acclimate to our environment and to begin again, right, to step in. And this is something we do in our practice. It's probably a little easier because we don't have necessarily mandatory feelings around our programs, but we do let people start where they're ready. So if we've put out a whole bunch of painting stuff and some 13-year-old's not having it, arms crossed, sitting in the corner, we'll let you do that for a little bit. Just stay safe. Don't hurt anybody. Don't hurt yourself. And then when you're ready, let's do something you want to do. And more often than not, they work themselves into it, right? And so that's an important signal that we give as a group, that we can recognize that it's you're not a machine. And it's hard for us to expect you to be that way. And then when we do in a school environment, I'll just be fair to that. It's because we have a lot of people, we got to move through a lot of spaces on time. So that causes us to create routines that make things feel almost like a factory. And if you doubt me, just be a visitor in the school cafeteria as it shifts through all the students, right? That thing needs to click on point and we can't let second grade take too long or the whole day is ruined. And people, you know, really experience that. So I think you're right on. We have to remember the humanity of the people in our spaces.
How do you work to build, like you build a safe environment? How do you get your kids to feel safe to come do their painting after they'd sit in the corner for a little while? Like, what does that look like? Does it look different for different kids?
100%. And in fact, it's one of the key components of our approach to training the people that we work with, because we are not clinical art therapy. We train regular, non-clinically trained adults to do these programs. Some of them are very talented and professional level artists. Some just love the arts and participate at their level. But when we think about safety, what we're doing are the cues that you belong, that we will be patient with your readiness, that we will provide a set of instructions, right? Like when I was going through teacher training, we talked about lesson set and how important it was to like tell the students, here are the objectives of the day. And at the time I thought it was really silly. Like they don't really care that this is 6.7-1. And they don't, but they do need to be told where we're going today and why and how we're going to do it. And so belonging, that you are enough, that we will start with where you are. We have a powerful mantra here that there are no mistakes in art. That's also hard for the math teacher in me to say, because I couldn't say there are no mistakes in math, because they're the tests. They don't grade themselves. So that's not really that possible to say it that way. But what we can say is there's no mistakes in the way that you're showing up and trying today. We can just do different strategies to achieve a different outcome. So there's part of it to the physical space, which is minor. This is something we actually evaluate pretty heavily in our programming, because it's kind of baselining, right? Do they feel safe here? both physically and then emotionally. So that emotionally, the emotional component is about just belonging, that they understand what we're doing today. We're giving some directions about what our goal is today. We give people two things, voice and choice, which is kind of hard to do in a school environment. You have to be kind of wise. This is where your sophisticated master teacher is very good, because they've incorporated voice and choice. Like, how do I give them a sense of what they want to do today, even though I know I have to get these things done? And how do I include them in how we go about it? And then how do we provide choices when that's important? So when you think about even like first grade doing stations and rotations and giving people the chance to practice at their station on their own, right? These are all these small cues that you're a person at a certain pace and that you're important. And then when you think about connection before correction, right? It's the difference between arriving at school and being immediately yelled at by a strange adult on the playground versus, hi, I'm Miss So-and-so. What's your name? Okay, great. Welcome to this school. Just want to give you a word of advice about how we do things on the playground. Do the following. These are different experiences than just blowing your whistle and immediately screaming. And again, I'm from the 80s, so that's what the tool was, just let's cue the immediate screaming. And that's just not good for people. And then we can't figure out why everybody's dysregulated and edgy all the time. Well, we train them to be. So I think that's a few things here within the teacher's arsenal. Schools, although I think people need to remember, especially when they work in an environment, they're pretty stressful work environments, right? I don't work in a school, which means I get to go to the bathroom whenever I want. Yeah. And most of your audience is like, where's so-and-so? You know, needs that relief that somebody can come by and watch their class for a minute. And, you know, there's nothing like being halfway through your sandwich and the bell rings, you know? So there's just these elements, right? And if you're in this big campus setup where you can hear everything, you know, there's a sound of some unhappy seven-year-old being heard down the hallway about this or that. And it's just how kids are. It's not really about the school. So those are things that I also think are important, that we know the environment itself can be a little charged. So we do what we can, you know, we decorate a certain way, we use music, we use light, we use movement. These are all things that activate the parts of us to help us discharge a little energy, but then also help us have fun, right? Fun is okay at school. We all like that, and that will help. And that ultimately comes back to just honoring that basic humanity that people bring in when they step in your classroom.
Oh, sorry. My daughter tried to FaceTime call me on my computer here. I was going to ask you.
It's so funny. Like every time I do like music off my phone, I'm like, this is when my mom's going to call me, you know, because it's only like, she's basically the only person who still calls me first on the phone. So it's like, this is when she's going to call, when it's on Bluetooth on a public speaker. But,
yep. Absolutely. Anyhow. Absolutely. I was going to, so you're obviously not in school, but do you ever go in, do you partnership with any schools at all and like provide?
Yeah, it's a great question. We do, when we can identify the population we serve. And so in Arizona, we have a lot of charter schools, and there are some charter schools that as a mission target like youth who live in homeless environments. And so there's one here that it's about 100 plus students. And so in that case, we will go for several weeks and serve the entire school. So we don't do recreational arts for broad audiences. Yeah. And I just have this crazy thought too. So if you're in Arizona listening, and this connects to you, but like when I, and I only did this for a short period of time, was a school counselor and in a K-8. So it wasn't like guidance counseling. It literally was like triage and often referral to treatment or resources. I knew who the kids were who came from the group home van. I knew the vans. I knew who the kids were. And so if there's somebody out there who says, I know 24 kids in this large school that this fits and we want to do a multi-week art program, would you come and do it? The answer would be like, yeah, I would do that. So that's some small examples of how we work alongside. It's been important for us at a level, not that not all children are special, but in terms of kind of keeping your mission tied to a population, because you have to distinguish yourself for funding purposes. Unlike schools where just the fact that they showed up means they're going to be funded, you know, by the powers that be, that's not what we're able to do. We have to kind of guard who we're serving. And so in that way, those audiences, as they're identified in the school and want to partner with us, that's something we can do. And then outside of Arizona, people are like, wow, this is kind of interesting. I wonder what they do. Can I learn it? Absolutely. Check out our website. Come to our symposium, which is in August. Come learn. And we really consider Arizona where we operate. But if you're inspired and do this elsewhere, that's all good for you. And we're happy to help out or consult if needed. So those are options for people that are listening.
And is it mostly, do you do just individual therapy, or is it group, or does it depend on, you know, the situation, or if you have kids that have like similar maybe issues they're going through, that you do that as a group?
Everything's group.
Is it?
So
okay.
That helps us. It helps us work more efficiently with the environments we're in. Another important thing is 95, if not more, percent of who or where we do our programming is where children live. So you don't have to come to our building. We have a great facility in downtown Phoenix, but we are doing most of our programming either in the shelter, in the group home, or the treatment center. And like I said, in those small cases, the schools themselves. So doing that in the group allows everybody there to take part, right? And we do this by bracketing by some age groups. So we don't have like 7-year-olds and 9-year-olds. We'll split those groups up, but we're able to put groups together. Because we serve that way, they're often facing the same situation.
Okay.
So we don't even need to ask, you know, what's your qualifying event? You don't have to tell us why you're here, what you've been through. Some are processing that anyway, right? When we start dealing with the arts, we're doing this fabulous thing called feeling. And it's what we do as humans to process what's important to us. And maybe some of the things that have been hard for us to realize, even though they might be important to us. So we serve in groups. We do different styles of programming, all the way from 4 to 6 week with a professional artist, where there's an exhibition on the other end, painting, guitar, performance. We have camps that are day camps that are week long, where they're involved in programming on a rotation schedule for 6 hours a day. That's probably the most powerful programming we have in terms of outcomes. And then we have programs that are set up to be longer lasting because they're drop-in, like weekly mentor program. And those are facilitated by just adults willing to do it. They don't even have to be art experts or professional artists. So anyone who says, I care about this cause, I want to work with young people, if you give me the activities and the instructions, I can lead it. So weekly mentors for you. So those are things that we do here. So we have kind of a scalable approach. Everything's done in group, but that fits what we're after. Is we're looking at Art Heals Arizona as a way to say that the experience of creativity mirrors important processes that humans need. Because when we're doing art together, if you're teaching me, I'm mirroring what you're doing, which is exactly the thing we're missing when we're upset and the person who's supposed to be listening to us isn't, is they're not mirroring very well. They're on their phone, they're distracted, they're driving, they're not listening, whatever it might be. But in that moment of instruction around art and creativity, we're activating parts of the brain that cause us to notice when we're being mirrored, cause us to want to share, to experience multiple sharing, to have that in sync feeling you have by doing the same thing with a group. And these are really powerful things that are almost subconscious forces in people. It's part of our species. It's how we've been kind of wired over time as humanity. And so these things cross cultures. A really cool thing is you can do our activities without all speaking the same language. And that is helpful for us to kind of break down things that might feel like differences at other times.
There we go. Sorry. I thought I had my phone off. There it goes. I don't know if you guys can hear that or not. Sorry, my phone was ringing through my... That's the problem with Apple. It rings through everything. Can you guys still hear me? Okay,
perfect. Yes.
All right. Bree, what do you got?
When we had our first initial meeting, you talked about treasure hunting. Would you like to speak on that a little bit?
Yes, this is a very important part of what we do when we train mentors. And it goes back to that question of how do you build some safety? And so what we really want to do as we explain this to our mentors, those who work with us, and to give some credit where it's due, there was a researcher named Rick Miller who worked from Arizona State University and then later founded a group called Kids at Hope. So at, this was 20 plus years ago when we were really shifting our language from deficit, kids at risk, to, yeah, there might be a moment here where we need to intervene or prevent a future issue, but this kid has innate talents and skills that if are given the right amount of attention, support, environment, will take over on their own. And so treasure hunting is, even in the midst of difficult behavior, of a challenging relationship with a young person, to examine them from the lens of what do they bring to this situation that's a skill, a talent, an attribute, something that they can rely on. Even if they're the kid who takes no amount of vagueness and speaks up for the group and is like, this isn't fair. I hear a need for justice. That's a strong strength. That's something coming through, even if they're the loud one, right? And again, your professional has been in the field a minute, knows I work with this, not against it. But when we're new, we think our number one requirement, and unfortunately we're kind of taught that it is control the behavior at all costs. Well, you can't control all behavior at all costs, but we can give it outlets that fit our general purpose, right? And so these soft moves of the outspoken person getting a little bit of leadership role, being able to represent and do that thing in a space that feels good to them. So treasure hunting for us is seeing behavior as communication, seeing past what might be labeled as troublesome behavior. And we're not minimizing. So if you're a threat to the public or public health or safety, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the grumpiness, the irritability. We're talking about, I can't sit next to other people without a conflict happening. What do we see that's true about this person, whether it's that skill or an attitude or an interest that we can work from? So treasure hunting is shorthand here for looking for that. And the truth is, it doesn't just work for kids. We have to do this with colleagues too, because that's a very confusing thing as a professional. When you're young, you think everybody you're supposed to be around all the time is going to be your friend. In reality, no. Once you get out in the field working for a long time, the only thing in common is you both get paid by the same place to keep showing up. That's the only thing you really have in common. Now, everything else might be in addition to that. And so we have to treasure hunt our colleagues sometimes. You know, when we recognize that somebody's a little isolated, they are quiet, but they show up in these other ways. And I've learned, as a teacher taught me, like, always look for the quiet one, because they're the one in the back, like figuring out all the math and drawing this amazing thing that's gallery style art, right? So these are examples of drawing in from somebody's basic toolkit and acknowledging that, giving it more space.
Yeah, you made a great point, because like you said, when you're a young teacher and a kid kind of questions it of, you know, that's not fair, you almost seem like as a teacher, it's just, you know, well, this is what we're doing. So it doesn't matter, you know, there's no wiggle room there. Like, why don't you want to sit next to this kid? Well, I made the seating chart, so this is why you're going to do it, or this is where you're going to sit, without asking, you know, if they push back a little bit, okay, they have a valid reason. And honestly, it makes, in the end, it makes it easier for you as a teacher, because it's a simple thing that really you don't need to push back against, of letting them sit somewhere else. And it's going to make your job 3 weeks down the road so much easier, instead of a right. fight every single day that really doesn't need to be there. And I think
It's a mini test of trust, right? Yeah. That simple thing of like, I don't want to sit there. Okay, could you do me a favor and sit there for now? I'll come back to you in a second and we'll talk about it while you get everybody else sitting down, because you're trying to solve a process problem.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And this kid's going to tell you that, hey, he punched me 2 years ago. You don't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so totally legitimate reason to not want to sit over
yep.
here.
Yeah.
And so when you come back and say, okay, you want to tell me what's going on? Can we solve it together? And then you do, you develop this little bit of, I can speak up for myself. I can do it in a way that you'll hear me, like signal received, sent and signal received, right? And that we can work through something here that will build a little bit of, you know, working capital between us, that you'll tell me the truth. I'll see what I can do for you. Also, there are times where it's not possible. We might have to talk through how we handle that, right? So Those are good points.
Yeah, I think
new teachers, like, really, you don't know until you have experience. And how do you get experience? You just got to go in and do it.
You do it wrong.
Yeah, you do it wrong. Like, I'm in a different role. I used to teach, I used to be in the gen ed classroom, and now I work for a nonprofit within the same school Chris teaches in. And my role is more about building relationships and getting these kids future skills, where, like, when I was starting out, like, being a biology teacher, I was like, okay, we're not going to smile till Christmas. Like, I have, like, I rule with an iron fist. Like, it was really hard. And I actually started out teaching middle school science, and I had a principal who, I had this really tough girl. Like, she hated me. We did not see eye to eye. Like, I was like, she was just naughty every day. And my principal pulled me into the office, and he was like, I just need you to try and build a relationship with her. I need you to talk to her. I need you to try and understand. And right then I was just so mad. I was like, no, she needs to, like, sit down and do her work and do what I ask. And, like, looking back on it, like, I know that I just needed more time to, like, build relationships with these kids. And that, I think, becoming a mom has made me way more patient. And you don't realize till you have, like, kids or someone you have to take care of that, yeah, you do need to have patience with these kids, and it's not always going to be your way. So I think just having that experience in the education world really helps you develop those relationships with kids and be like, okay, Timmy is not feeling it today. I got to meet him where he's at. If he needs to sleep today, like, because he was up all night working, like, he needs to sleep. So I think it just takes time, and that's a super valuable lesson that I have learned along the way.
Yeah. And I think at the mixed levels of our audience here, there's opportunity here at the leadership level to realize it's really not fair to you as the teacher to come in and say, hey, just go do this thing called build relationship with this difficult, right? It's not actually because you're coming for help there in that scenario, because you're just as reactive as the kid is. You're straight up not having a good time neither, right? Like, this is not your moment.
Yeah.
And you're looking for some, you're looking for that master teacher administrator to say, okay, this is common. This is what happens. You're feeling an instinct for control. You're probably, and you let people edit this, right? We conjecture. Maybe it feels like this. And maybe it feels like if I were to walk in there and this kid's doing that it's going to reflect on you. But, like, that administrator, they know them too. Like, they've met them. You think they're nicer to the principal suddenly? Like, this is a theme, right? This is a theme with the student we're dealing with. And so, you know, when we think about mentoring teachers, there is room both for skills and techniques and build the relationship. But, you know, stress between, poor communication between, is really the enemy of relationship, right? These are the things that make it hard to connect. So when I feel like I have to control you, that kid's going to pick up on that. And there might be really valid reasons why this kid resists adult control, have nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
And nor is your, you know, new worksheet or your fancy cue word or whatever new technique they've brought into the classroom, is it really going to help? But I think a good leader can help that teacher go, how is this impacting you? What is causing your reactivity, right? There's a saying in boxing, which is not as popular as it used to be, that it is actually styles that make fights. So when you think about classic matchups, it's the people involved and the styles they bring that either make something super boring or super exciting. So sometimes what's happening in the classroom is your style of processing the world and a certain student's, they're lining up to be magic, a little sparky. And so as the adult in the space, self-awareness starts with, what am I bringing that's reactive to this? This person pushes what buttons in me? And if we can see those buttons and hold them a little lightly, a little differently, or let your administrator tell you, I'm never writing you up because that person made you feel that way, and you can let go of that pressure, that can help engage. But if you think you've got to control the entire dynamic and make it go well, that's a really tall task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, self-awareness is hard when you're in the moment. And I've caught myself a couple times of that power struggle with a kid. Like, they start to argue, so then you start to argue. I'm like, wait a second, what am I doing? It's just, but it's hard because you're amped up and they're amped up. And it's especially if, you know, when you talk about administrator, when you have an observation and then it doesn't go smoothly because a kid has had a bad day and then, you know, they're starting to, you know, let that be known and it's in, you're all in, you know, you feel the eyes in the back of your head of an administrator. It you know, makes that situation very, very stressful for the teacher. So like you mentioned of having an administrator say, you know, hey, I understand this kid. I know I've seen him before. I know what he's like. I mean, that can help alleviate a lot as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So Matt, what, so it's Art Heals Arizona.
Yes. Okay. That's where we're headed.
So my question then is, do you, since it's Art Heals Arizona, do you see in the future, do you have a plan in the future of having Art Heals, you know, name that state, or is it just what you guys thought for the name?
It's what we thought to ground us geographically. We don't have plans to be nationwide or to do a franchising model. Frankly, Arizona is big enough for us, you know, so we've been in Maricopa County, which for those that are familiar is a very large county where Phoenix and all the other big and well-known suburbs like Scottsdale and Chandler are. And we've been serving in this area pretty strongly for 30 plus years and more recently in Tucson, which is south of us by about 90 minutes. And there's still other parts of the state. So our position is that we centered ourselves in Arizona with the name. But if there are others outside of us that would like to take what we do here, replicate, model, reshape it to fit your neighborhood, we'd love to talk about that because that's a good thing for the world. But rather than promise we'll be in your neighborhood soon, we would rather inspire people to take things back and incorporate it into their school, their environment, their nonprofit.
And then do you travel quite a bit for, you know, PDs as well, like professional developments of, you know, and talking to schools?
Yeah, I do some locally. That's a great question because on top of what we do and what we know what works here, there are also just related ways to engage. So many of the things we're talking about around treasure hunting, we design talks and workshops that come in and really talk about the essential components. We'll use probably mentoring as the stand-in word, but teaching and teacher educator is very close to a mentor relationship. And in fact, sometimes they actually just take that shape depending on what's happening. But there are some things we know that help build connection, that help regulate in the moment, also provide clarity, also give good boundaries to the adults. To know how do I, one of our mantras is take the lesson, leave the story, which means I don't need to tell you about my interpersonal history of trauma. I can tell you that I know what it feels like to feel scared at home. I can tell you what it feels like to feel abandoned, to have be let down by people who are supposed to take care of me. And what you're doing there is building connection without asking somebody to carry your harm when they're not able to. And so those are things that we can teach other people. So the simple answer is we do some workshops like that locally, kind of as an add-on. We have our own art symposium in August, but it is on my mind. So it's a natural question of like, you know, it'd be great because there are times we've come in to a PD for teachers on a Friday afternoon. I just did this last week, actually. And we did a mentorship talk and we made art in 90 minutes and people took their principles and made a collage and they have something, the collage stands in for the things they're willing to do in their relationships with young people. And they're leaving on a Friday with smiles because art does it. I would love to say it's my awesome workshop, but art is what does it. So those are things that people can reach out to. We'd be happy to do it. Do a lot of it here locally, but we do travel. We've been doing a lot of traveling to take some of our evaluation findings. We're really excited that very soon we're going to have an article about building safety in our environments published in the Journal of Child Welfare, a peer-reviewed journal article at an academic level. So this has all been a mountain we've been climbing to say, does our program work? If so, how? And is it worth sharing? So we're showing that that is all the case, and we're happy to share the transferable skills from our environment to any person who cares about young people and works with families as well.
Perfect. Well, Bree, is there anything else you've got? Otherwise, I think that would be a great way to wrap it up.
Yeah, I don't have any other questions.
Matt, you have anything else you want to add before we we sign off?
Yeah, just check us out, freeartsaz.org. That will still be live even after the name change for about 2 years. So this will die off too quickly. And then in the future, artheelsaz.org, where will be where you can find us. And you can contact me, Matt Sandoval, on LinkedIn. It's probably the easiest way to catch me. Those are things I check regularly. And yeah, if this is resonating with you, you want to talk about how best to create environments to help people grow through hardship, I'd love to put our heads together and see what comes from that. But in the end, you know, create some space for relationship, create space for art expression. When you put these things together, they multiply each other. They don't just add. So on that note, thanks for letting me be on your show today.
Well, thanks for joining us, Matt. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. This is great.
All right. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.